Dr. Paul Offit gets his share of hate mail. And I suspect we might hear this hour from some pretty angry callers. Calls from listeners, perhaps, who have a child with autism and who blame vaccines for their child's condition. Dr. Offit says the science is clear, and despite what you hear from some journalists or celebrities or even some other doctors, vaccines do not cause autism. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, September the 18th. We will welcome in now Dr. Paul Offit, the Chief of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, of Philadelphia. He is the author of the book, Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
You're also the co-inventor of a vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine, Rotatech.
That's correct.
And I bring that up because some will say, well, you know, you're reading the science because you have the way you do because of a financial consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly heard that accusation. It makes little sense to me. I mean, the logic behind that accusation is that I would spend 25 years working with a team here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia so that we could develop a vaccine that has the potential to save 2,000 lives a day, so that I can make money, so that I can lie about vaccine safety, so that I can hurt children. I mean, doesn't it make infinitely more sense that the reason that I work on a rotavirus vaccine that can save lives is the same reason that I stand up for vaccine science and the science of vaccine safety, because I care about children, which is true.
Yeah. And you are also donating the profits of this book for the Search for a Cure.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So tell us, who are autism's false prophets?
Well, I think, you know, there are people who have represented the notion that initially that the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, or that more recently that thimerosal and ethylmercury-containing preservative in vaccines caused autism, that continue to represent that notion, despite, I think, clear and consistent and reproducible science that shows that's not true. And I think what I think is so upsetting about this, and I think so damaging ultimately to children with autism, is that has done a lot of harm. Harm because some children aren't getting vaccines they need, harm because children can be subjected to potentially dangerous therapies, and harm because that hypothesis that vaccines are a problem continues to draw a lot of resources in terms of scientific studies that could be spent on far more promising leads.
Why do you think, after so many studies saying there's not a link, that people persist with the belief?
Because I think people buy into this notion, or some people, it's not I think certainly not all parents of children with autism, but certainly some parents of children with autism hold on to this notion much as one would hold on to a religious belief, I mean zealously. Because the fact is that there isn't a clear cause, or there aren't clear causes of autism spectrum disorder, and there's certainly no clear, easy cure or treatment. The notion that vaccines would have caused it, or say that thimerosal in vaccines would have caused it, which is to say the mercury in vaccines would have caused it, and that one can therefore rid themselves of mercury and therefore watch their child get better, is very attractive because it at least offers a cure. And I think, you know, when you see, and this is, I think, historically always true in medicine, when you see diseases for which there isn't a clear cause or there isn't a clear cure, I think this kind of quackery and charlatanism abounds. That's historically been true.
Well, I hear from parents doing programs on this from time to time that my child was fine until I got these vaccines, and then now my child has autism.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable to raise the question. I mean, that's exactly right. My child was fine. They got a vaccine. Then they're not fine anymore. Was it the vaccine that did it? And the way that you answer that question, whether it was initially with the MMR vaccine or with thimerosal-containing vaccines, is look at hundreds of thousands of children who received, for example, MMR, compare them to hundreds of thousands of children who didn't receive MMR to see whether or not there's any difference in the risk of autism. And there hasn't been. The same is true with thimerosal, which has largely been out of vaccines since 2001, yet still the instance of autism continues to increase. So, I mean, the science clearly exonerates it. It's it's frustrating, I think, when it continues to be a controversy, because to me it's not a scientific, not to me, I think to anybody who's looked at the data, it's not a scientific controversy. So the controversy really is between those who believe in science and those who don't, which I think is frightening.
Yeah. Well, what about Dr. Bernadine Healy? Let's listen to what she had to say recently.
This is the time when we do have the opportunity to understand whether or not there are susceptible children, perhaps genetically, perhaps they have a metabolic issue, mitochondrial disorder, immunological issue, that makes them more susceptible to vaccines, plural, or to one particular vaccine, or to a component of vaccine like mercury. So we now, in these times, have to, I think, take another look at that hypothesis, not deny it.
Take another look at it, Dr. Offit?
Yeah, I'm not sure what she's referring to. Certainly, with regard to the measles, mumps, rubella hypothesis, there have been now 10 epidemiological studies, very sensitive epidemiological studies, that have been done on several different continents by many investigators who have failed to find a whit of evidence that supports the notion that MMR caused autism. Similarly, there are now 6 studies that look at thimerosal as a cause of autism, again done by many different investigators on different continents, all of which have been shown a clear and consistent and reproducible result. I think it's unfair when Dr. Healy continues to point people away from the science that is so much better and so much clearer, that at least is starting to direct one to what are the cause or causes of autism. I think it's in many ways irresponsible on her part.
Yeah. We also, in the news earlier this year, I think it was in March, there was a lawsuit that I think confused a lot of people. Here's the CNN lead into this report. The parents of a 9-year-old girl with autism said that their assertion that her illness was caused by childhood vaccines has been vindicated by the federal government's decision to compensate them. They received an award from the government.
Yeah, you're talking about the Hannah Poland case.
That's
and I think, you know, it's just yet another example of why it is that scientific issues should be addressed in a scientific venue. I don't think one goes to or looks to court to try and, or to courts to try and understand scientific issues. I mean, people go to court to settle disputes, not to determine scientific truths, because certainly there is no evidence to support the contention that vaccines cause autism. So I can't explain how the court thinks in many ways.
Yeah, but so the science is on your side. The court decided to settle.
And that's, you know, I mean, if you look, certainly, I mean, you know, I live in the city of Philadelphia where, you know, where a case was brought by a woman who claimed to be a psychic that had a CT scan, and following the CT scan, she claimed that she lost her psychic powers. I mean, that came to a courtroom in Philadelphia where, in fact, the doctor in the hospital that performed the CT scan were found to be liable, and she won $900,000. But do I think that there's any scientific evidence that would is consistent with the notion that a psychic would lose their CT, their psychic powers in a CT scan? No. I mean, I just think that's what happens when things go to judges and juries. They get, the science gets warped.
Yeah. And we do have a number of celebrities, notably Jenny McCarthy has been making rounds talking to Oprah and Larry King and others about her son who has autism and her very strong belief that this was exacerbated at least by vaccines. So that's another. Is she a false prophet?
Yes, but I mean a well-meaning one, as I think many are. From Jenny McCarthy's, I can't speak for Jenny McCarthy, but I'm assuming that, you know, that her child has autism, that when she either chelated or gave a gluten-free diet or casein-free diet, that she watched improvement. And I think what we're doing now is essentially replaying events that occurred 10 years ago with a medicine called Secretin. I mean, then there was a woman named Victoria Beck whose child had autism and also some intestinal problems, took them to the University of Maryland, where the child was, as part of his evaluation, injected with a hormone called Secretin, which is a hormone that actually increases secretion of pancreatic juices. And she felt that within days that her child was dramatically better. And so thus was born the notion that Secretin, given intravenously, could make your child's autism better. Until it went, and and thousands of parents did this. This is spending, you know, thousands of dollars trying to get a very difficult medicine injected intravenously into their child. When it was studied, and children were given either Secretin or given intravenous salt water, and it was a blinded prospective controlled study, it was found that there was no difference between the salt water or the Secretin. And that study was repeated 15 times until eventually Secretin sort of faded away. But and I think that's what you say. I mean, we always, you know, because I think it's a disorder which has some natural waxing and waning, and it's a disorder also that at least in some cases gets better over time. You know, we're trying to look for what made that better, and I think that it's easy to ascribe cause and effect when there isn't a cause and effect.
Yeah, my neighbor who has a daughter with autism now is talking about going to hyperbolic chambers. And that's the new treatment, she says, for at least that she's trying.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, the history of medicine is one where hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which is a way of increasing the amount of oxygen in your bloodstream, has been used historically often for diseases or disorders where there isn't a near cause. I mean, this was done with multiple sclerosis. It's been done with diabetes. It's just, it's something to do. And you know, the doctors who were willing to do it, and certainly have parents pay out of pocket to do it. I mean, some parents take out a second mortgage on their home to get a home hyperbaric oxygen chamber. I mean, it's frankly quackery. And I think the thing that is most upsetting to me in this whole story is that there's a scientific journal called Science, which is a publication of the American Academy of Sciences, and their July 11th issue. It's worth reading. I mean, it's not easy reading, obviously, but there's in that journal, what they do is they go through the genetics of autism, and they sort of show these 30 genes now that have been associated with autism. They show the proteins that those genes make, and it clearly drives you to the brain, you know, where specifically the area where one brain cell communicates with another brain cell, the synapse, and it looks at these proteins, which have, you know, fancy names like norexin and neuroligin, that is a pattern that's starting to emerge. So it looks like the genes that are associated with autism are making proteins that help one brain cell communicate with another, that help proteins move within brain cells. That's all very interesting. And it may, in fact, one day lead to at least, you know, treatments that can modify the disease. That's a real hope, but you never hear about it. And I think in part it's because those who oppose vaccines have successfully taken this autism story hostage, much to the detriment of children with autism.
Our guest is Dr. Paul Offit. He is the author of the book Autism's False Prophets: Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. Dr. Offit, also Chief of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number, if you have a question for Dr. Offit, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Thursday, September the 18th. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, during this hour, it's our Friday Week in Review. Looking forward to that, but especially looking forward to doing this on location in Superior tomorrow. The Joyride is hitting the campaign trail. We'll be traveling the state for the rest of this month and through October, every Friday, broadcasting from a different location. Tomorrow we'll be at Barker's Island Inn and Conference Center in Superior, broadcasting from 6 until 9, guests and a live audience. You can stop by, free and open to the public. Hope you will if you're in the Superior region, as we broadcast live from Superior. It's the Week in Review with two guests from Superior as our guests coming up tomorrow. Right now, we're talking about autism and talking with a guest who says autism is not caused by vaccines, and a guest who says that a lot of the so-called treatments for autism are not effective. Paul Offit is the author of Autism's False Prophets: Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. And our first caller for him is Julie in Mayville. Hi, Julie, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what Dr. Offit would say to me. My granddaughter became autistic overnight after her 4-month vaccinations.
Right. So you're therefore it's overnight. Yeah. How about that? Let's talk about that first, Dr. Offit. You know, when something like that happens, you can't help but say, "Hey, did that vaccine have something to do with it?"
Yes, and it's certainly compelling. I think, you know, individual experiences or anecdotes are quite compelling. I'll give you an example of one. My wife's in private practice pediatrics, and she came into the office on a weekend day, and there was a shortage of nurses, so she ended up giving a lot of the vaccines herself. And there was one, as a four-month-old child was sitting on her mother's lap, and while my wife was drawing up a vaccine into a syringe, the child had a seizure. It lasted for about 10 minutes, and it ended up that she actually had a seizure disorder, meaning she went on to have several episodes of seizures throughout her life and was diagnosed, obviously, with epilepsy. There had been a family history of epilepsy. But that seizure occurred while my wife was drawing up the vaccine into the syringe. I think if she had given that vaccine 5 minutes earlier, there is no amount of statistical data in the world that would have convinced her of anything other than that the vaccine caused it, even if the vaccine didn't cause it. And I'm certainly sympathetic to the notion that, you know, that anecdote is a very powerful thing, but I do think that you know, that although we're always looking for causes for in this case autism, I think raising the question is reasonable. But you know, when the studies are done to look at whether or not these vaccines cause it, and they can't find any evidence that it's true, I think we have to believe them.
And that's how autism can come on. You're a happy, you know, a baby engaged with the world, and all of a sudden, the next day, you're not. That's how the autism presents itself?
Well, obviously not. I mean, you know, autism is a disorder, you know, that's characterized by defects or deficits in speech and language and communication and behavior, and you know, the signs can be subtle and soft. And so I think, you know, it's not like it's dramatically happening at one moment. Presumably because it's clearly genetic, you know, that those genes are in place and associated with childhood development, actually probably even in utero.
Yeah. Well, I guess the CDC or the federal government was concerned enough about this anecdotal evidence to take that thimerosal, the mercury preservative, out of vaccines for children.
Actually, it worked the other way.
Oh, okay.
I think what ended up happening was, you know, certainly as children got more and more vaccines, and we got, say, roughly 7 vaccines in 1980, at least by 2 years of age. Now we get about 14 vaccines today by 2 years of age. And as, you know, because mercury, ethyl mercury thimerosal is used as a preservative in several vaccines, the quantity of mercury that children were getting was increasing. Now, it was always less than the amount of mercury that children were receiving, say, in breast milk. I mean, you know, mercury is part of the Earth's surface, and, you know, we're exposed to mercury all the time. So, and it's always a dose issue, frankly. So, but it was never, I mean, it was always, frankly, a trivial amount. But still, the feeling was is that, you know, that there was a concern just in generally about excipient materials used in vaccines. So let's take this out because we can. Why don't we just move from single dose, from multi-dose vials to single dose vials where you don't need a preservative and thus eliminate, you know, mercury from vaccines, which had been done in Europe, frankly, in the early 1990s. When they did that, I mean, the way that the American Academy of Pediatrics, frankly, did it was in such a precipitous and frightening manner that it actually created the notion that thimerosal was doing harm. And that gave birth, actually, to several parent advocacy groups that believe this to be true. But it was actually the removal that caused the concern more than the other way around.
Okay. And since then, though, the autism rates continue to rise, which is evidence that it didn't have anything to do with it?
Yes.
Yeah. Julie, did you have something more than your experience with your grandchild that one day, you know, that it happened overnight? Did you have another question or comment? No, I guess not. Leisha in De Pere. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a daughter that is 13 years old. She was diagnosed with very high-functioning autism at age 5. And I want to thank the doctor because I really feel that genetically I have a 94-year-old grandfather that absolutely has autism, but was obviously not diagnosed. I do feel there is family history, and only in the last 10, 15 years have we learned to diagnose what these symptoms were that were not going on, you know, when he was a child and or a younger adult.
So you're convinced it's genetic?
I absolutely feel that there's a genetic connection. Absolutely. I mean, my daughter had a lot of ear infections as a child, or a younger child, and I think that helped. I don't know if that her speech patterns were. It took her till 3 and a half to actually talk more than 3 words in a row. Mm. But, you know, she's a really happy kid. And I think my only way of describing it is, you know, you do, as they grow, learn to accept people for who they are. And really, she has, if you want to turn it into a positive, taught her mother more than anybody's taught me.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Dr. Offit, a reaction?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think her instincts are right. The way that scientists try and initially prove whether or not, or see whether or not something has a genetic component, is to do something called family studies, twin studies. So when one, and this has been done with autism for actually a couple decades ago, when one identical twin has autism, the chance that a second identical twin will have autism is greater than 90%. When one fraternal twin has autism, the chance that a second fraternal twin will have autism is actually less than 10%. And so it's at least genetic, and you know, now people are looking at the genes. And I think, you know, what's frustrating is it's not like sickle cell disease, for example, which is just a single mutation on a single gene, or it's not like cystic fibrosis, which also is one gene that makes one protein. It's clearly many genes that make many proteins that interact, probably, you know, starting from the first trimester in utero. And so it's not going to be, you know, a very easy puzzle to solve. But I think your caller is exactly right that it's genetic, I think, is not an issue, a matter of dispute.
Yeah. I have heard from guests on this program who believe that, yes, there is this genetic component of autism, but that it is made worse, or you get the autism because of the toxic metals in our environment and all, you know, mercury in the environment, other contaminants, and then on top of that, you know, put the mercury, if the mercury is in these vaccines, that just adds to it. Is there anything to that theory?
Not yet. I mean, you know, people certainly have looked at mercury. They've looked at measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. More studies will be done looking at aluminum. But I really do see those as blind leads. I think that because the Earth's surface contains these heavy metals like mercury or light metals like aluminum, and they're contained in vaccines actually at lesser quantities than you would be exposed to just naturally during your day. I don't think that's going to be money well spent. I mean, if fantasies could come true, I'd really like to see, you know, the money put into what are these far more promising leads about, you know, the way that the brain cell communicates with it, this sort of, you know, this, these two proteins, neuroligin, norexin. That's a fascinating story. It just is very frustrating that the media chooses never to cover it.
Yeah. So what about these chelation treatments that we hear about?
Well, you saw actually just yesterday that the National Institutes of Mental Health, which was going to do a chelation study, has now canceled that study. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I didn't. Why did they cancel it?
Well, I think they thought it was unethical. That certainly the biological studies today and the epidemiological studies today don't support any role for mercury as a cause of autism. Mm-hmm. And because chelation, which is a kind of treatment whereby a medicine is given to a child and helps that, and the medicine binds to heavy metals like mercury and or lead and helps eliminate it from the body. Because chelation itself can have side effects which can be themselves dangerous. I think, you know, you could argue that children would be subjected to a therapy for which there wasn't a rational basis who may be harmed by it. I think that is the definition of an unethical study.
Next we go to Eileen in Green Bay. Hi, Eileen, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is, how are we to know when to trust the doctor when we're told that the vaccine is safe? 10 years ago, my daughter was given the rotavirus vaccine. It was my first child. I was assured it was perfectly safe. She ended up with an intussusception of her intestine in the ICU. She nearly died, and they took that vaccine off the market. Clearly, that was not a safe vaccine. And so now, you know, how are we to know? When are we going to believe it? I believed it then, and it wasn't true. So I'd just like the doctor to address that.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a very interesting point, which is that there was a vaccine. It was introduced in the United States in 1998 to prevent rotavirus disease, called RotaShield, and it was tested in about 10,000 children before licensure, and then it was marketed and sold in the United States and given to about 1 million children. When it was found to cause intussusception, which the caller correctly identified, which is an intestinal blockage, in about 1 per 10 10,000 children. So obviously, if you do a study of 10,000 children before licensure, you're not going to pick up something that's occurring in only 1 per 10,000 children. And when it was then given to 1 million children and it was found to clearly be a cause of intussusception, it was quickly taken off the market. I think what is reassuring in that story is the safety mechanisms that are in place post-licensure in this country. I mean, you know, when you do a study, and the second rotavirus vaccine, this is one that we worked with here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I mean, that study was done pre-licensure in 70,000 children. And so, I mean, you can be a little more comfortable that when our vaccine was tested pre-licensure that it doesn't cause intussusception 1 per 10,000 children, because I think we would have picked that up. But it doesn't tell you that it didn't cause intussusception at all. And I think when it's released, you know, there are mechanisms in this country, I think most primarily there's something called the Vaccine Safety Data Link. We're very quickly doing something called a rapid cycle analysis. You can see as the vaccine rolls out whether or not it causes a problem. And I think historically in this country, when vaccines have caused a problem, and this, you know, the intussusception problem with Rotashield was just one of them. You know, there was a polio vaccine made in 1955, which caused polio. I mean, it was made badly, and it caused polio. And very quickly, it too, within 2 weeks of being on the market, was taken off the market. So I think, you know, the good news about vaccines is that I think that there are safety mechanisms in place to pick up rare adverse events post-licensure very quickly. And certainly the CDC was very quick to take Rotashield off the market when there was even a hint that there was a problem. So you're right. I mean, you never really know. There's a very famous vaccine researcher who used to work at Merck named Maurice Hilleman, who was responsible for 9 of the 14 vaccines that are currently given to children. He used to say, I never breathe a sigh of relief until the first 3 million doses are out there. And I think that remains true, and that's not something that you're going to do pre-licensure. That's only going to be post-licensure.
Eileen, thank you for the call. Bill in Madison is with us now. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. First, let me say that I agree with your guest that there's no credible evidence that vaccines cause autism. But so my general question is, since a lot of times science, it's what we don't know that we don't know, what is the general level of evidence before one starts considering a hypothesis? And the example I'll give is a few months ago in the press, there was a small study about the link between microsomal disorders and vaccines, and I imagine it was that we don't normally test for microsomal disorders. They're underlying. They could be asymptomatic. The immune response caused by the vaccines may trigger something. It's not the vaccine's fault. There was an underlying genetic problem. But at what level do you start to look at those more seriously as being possible side effect causes?
Yeah, it's and again, this is sort of a reference to that Hannah Poling case, a child that had a mitochondrial enzyme deficiency, specifically with an enzyme called oxidative phosphorylase. Could that end because we every cell that we have has a mitochondria, because we need our mitochondria to convert nutrients into energy, and that these children are at special risk when they are stressed? I mean, is it possible that vaccines could have stressed her and caused her to have symptoms that at least were similar to autism spectrum disorder? It's a difficult question to sort of get to, but I guess what I would say is that vaccines in general are a very trivial stress to the immune system. I mean, you know, the number of viruses that we're infected with in the first few years of life, which is on average 6 to 10, is a far greater stress to the immune system than would vaccines be, which really only contain about 150 immunological components, which is trivial. I mean, a single bacterium contains between 2,000 and 6,000 immunological components, and we're colonized with trillions of them, to which we make an immune response. I mean, I would argue, and I argued actually in a New England Journal of Medicine piece that I wrote about this, that the immune response to vaccines is really a drop in the ocean of what we're typically encountering and managing every day. And I think that court decision was a poor one, because I think it sent the wrong message. The parents certainly were willing to stand up and say this proves that vaccines cause autism, which is certainly the government never said that. I mean, the government said that's not what we were deciding, but they haven't been very clear about what exactly it is they were deciding. And the other point is that if you look, for example, at all the genes now that have been identified, none of them are mitochondrial enzyme deficiency genes. So I don't think anything really points to the mitochondria as where the action is. I think it's going to be where one neuronal cell, brain cell, meets another.
All right.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Try Susan in Summit now. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 21-year-old son with autism who was diagnosed at 2, and I happen to have a PhD in physiology. And I have to applaud the doctor, because that has been very frustrating in my experience to go along and look at the data that was available when my son was diagnosed 21 years ago, and try and come up with what happened and what do I do when there was very little information. And then it seems like there's the cure of the week or the cure of the month. And I want to say also that, you know, being involved with other parents of children with autism is that there's a desperation that you can see where they want something, they want some answers. And I think there's, at least on my part, there was a certain element of guilt. It's like, yeah, I did this to him. And you want to look for a cause that's not your fault or something else. And I think, you know, that's what happens. But it gets very frustrating for me, at least, to work with a lot of these groups where, you know, they, like you say, they get on a roll of something non-scientific. Somebody once told me, because when my son got autism, when I diagnosed, I quit work and I stayed home. And people said to me, oh, you wasted your education. And my answer to them was, it has prepared me fantastically for dealing and advocating for my son. And so as a scientist and a mother, I just want to say thank you. And I 100% believe that, and I've never believed that
vaccine.
Yeah. Well, no, I believe that it's genes. I don't believe that it's the vaccinations that have caused the problem. And I've looked at the results in the studies, especially the early one that was done in, I don't know if it was Sweden or Denmark, where they studied them. They said, look, there's absolutely no relationship. And the people who aren't trained in science don't realize the cause-effect relationship, that just because things happen at the same time, that doesn't mean there's cause and effect.
I'm glad you called. Thank you so much, Susan. And Dr. Offit, you talk to mothers like Susan and talk about them in your book as well.
I think mothers like Susan are really the real heroes of this story. I don't have a child with autism, and I don't have to struggle in the way that Susan and others have to struggle. And I think that you know, to have that, to be, you know, to have that as a burden, and then still to be able to successfully stand up, you know, for the science and against, I think, these cures were, you know, at least on the face, they seem may offer something immediate. Don't. I think that takes a special kind of courage, and you really don't hear the media is doesn't typically cover people like Susan. It's too bad, because I think it's a real courage that she has, and I applaud her for it.
Yeah, and she's right when she says there's a desperation among some parents and a feeling that of guilt, perhaps wanting to blame something for what happened to their child.
Exactly. You know, there's one other quick point, just getting back to that secretin study. When that secretin study was done, and it clearly showed that it didn't matter whether you got secretin or salt water, you know, your behavior was indistinguishable, they went back to the parents and they said, okay, so here's the data. You know, there's no difference between using secretin or salt water. And these are parents that had spent thousands of dollars, you know, to drive hundreds of miles to get their children, you know, injected intravenously with secretin. And about 70% of those parents said they still wanted to use it, because not to use it meant at some level giving up any sense of hope, and that you can understand it, but it is a little sad.
Well, it is sad, and we hear that if a treatment is received in the first 3 years, that can be the most successful. But you know, what does a parent do if that treatment wasn't received then, or it wasn't successful? Do you just give up? Do you just say, well, that's the way it is? Don't try to find anything that might improve your child's condition?
No, I think probably the you know, and I'm not an autism expert, actually. I'm an infectious disease expert, but certainly I spent a lot of time talking to autism experts, and we have an autism center here at our hospital, and my sense is that there at least is decent empirical data that behavioral therapy, therapies, you know, started early may make some difference, but you know, they're expensive and they're, you know, sort of a little laborious, and it's obviously not the quick fix, you know, that Jenny McCarthy can offer by saying, look, just avoid gluten or casein in your diet and your child will be better. That's much more tangible and real, even if it doesn't make any difference.
Our guest is Dr. Paul Offit. His book, Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and the Search for a Cure. 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Offit, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. The House this week approved a measure that would ease a longstanding ban on offshore oil drilling. Kathleen and her guest after 9 will discuss spending legislation in Congress in the lead-up to the November elections. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking about autism with a guest who is convinced the science is very clear. Vaccines do not cause autism. And talking about why society is susceptible to bad science and why risky therapies put forward by many anti-vaccination activists are proliferating. Dr. Paul Offit is also chief of infectious diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. An email from Ron in Duluth. Could Dr. Offit speculate on the cause of the huge increase in the number of cases of autism? Could the use of infant formula that does not contain long-chain fatty acids that are in breast milk be a possible explanation? Dr. Offit?
Yeah, I think the first question is the premise correct? In other words, is there an increase in the incidence of autism? And again, I'm not an autism expert, but you know, the person who I think has been most persuasive in this in terms of presenting data is an autism expert in Montreal named Eric Fombone. And what he postulates is that we've broadened the definition of the disorder, and that certainly is true. In the early 1990s, around 1993, 1994, we did broaden that definition to include, you know, Asperger's, pervasive developmental delay, not otherwise specified, you know, Rett's, et cetera. That was all sort of included in there. And I think what it did is it took children who you know, had sort of a mild form of this on this spectrum, who may in the past have simply been described as, you know, as odd or different or nerdy, and now made that a disorder. And on the other side of the spectrum, children who had, you know, moderate to severe, you know, behavioral or speech abnormalities were also included in this. My wife, for example, sees children with Down syndrome who are said to have Down syndrome and autism, and that's really not autism. And so I think you see a couple things. You see that, you know, the diagnosis of mental retardation virtually, you know, disappearing while this goes up. And so I think it's worked at both ends of the spectrum. I'm not sure that it is an absolute increase, but again, I think that's open for discussion. And as far as you know, the breast milk and replacement and you know, the long chain fatty acid hypothesis, I've heard that before. It's a testable hypothesis, certainly, and one can look at children who did or did not receive, you know, that form of nutrition to see whether there was any difference. So It's testable. I don't think that's going to be where the money is, but it is testable.
Karen in Whitewater is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question and a comment. My question being, I would like to know who is funding these studies that say vaccines do not cause autism. Could it be the pharmaceutical industry that does, by and large, fund most medical schools in this country? Secondly, I would not like the listening public to think that what your guest said about single-dose vaccines containing no thimerosal or mercury. I just had my 4-year-old to the doctor 2 days ago, and inquired about a single-dose tetanus vaccine and if there's any thimerosal or mercury in it. He came back and told me that, yes, indeed, there was. So just to let everyone know that, you know, it's still out there. It's still in vaccines. So please take care.
No, this confuses me, too. It's like children's vaccine are not supposed to have this, but adults do, Dr. Offit?
Well, so there are still multi-dose preparations of influenza vaccine that can be given to young children that could contain preservative levels of thimerosal, and then there are, as the guest says, tetanus vaccines that could contain thimerosal. But again, I think you have to put that in perspective, which is that the quantity of methylmercury, which is environmental mercury, which has a half-life that is 10 times longer than thimerosal, that children receive just in breast milk in the first 6 months of life, is still much greater, logarithmically greater, than what one would ever get in vaccine, so which is ethylmercury, which is excreted far more quickly. So the notion that thimerosal is dangerous at the level contained in vaccines is just wrong, I mean, given that the dose is compared to what is just typically in the environment. The second part, or the first part of her question about who does the studies, I think that, you know, if you look at the 10 studies done with MMR or the 6 studies that have been done with thimerosal, those are generally done by academic institutions or by the centers in this country, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So I don't think pharmaceutical companies have funded them, but I frankly don't think it matters. I mean, I think it doesn't matter whether parent advocacy groups or religious groups or pharmaceutical companies or lawyers fund studies. I think what matters is the strength, internal consistency, and reproducibility of those studies. I think good science will be reproduced, bad science won't. And in this case, you know, certainly the good science has been reproduced over and over again. So, I mean, I understand that we live in a very cynical and distrustful and suspicious time, but I don't think that cynicism serves us well.
Well, I had said at the beginning of the hour that I thought we were going to get a lot of angry phone calls just because of past programs on this, and you do get a lot of emails that take you to task. You started your book with that people don't they don't like you speaking out on this.
Well, yeah, I think there is a small group of people who believe this strongly and who politicize it. I mean, who make it sort of personal and choose to attack anyone who stands up on behalf of good science. But I don't think that's certainly most people. It's certainly not most parents of children with autism. And I think I do get a lot of positive mail from people, you know, like Susan who called earlier, or another one of you. In fact, I think I'm moving to Wisconsin, given, you know, the nature of the callers. But so
nice.
I do get a lot of positive response. But yeah, there is that sort of small group that I think is can be a little mean spirited and personal, which is obviously completely unnecessary and irrelevant to the question.
Heather in New Holstein, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a wonderful program. I did have a question for the doctor. I wondered if he knew of any studies that showed a link between environmental triggers to the gene deformities, or if there's any evidence that other neurological disorders can eventually manifest as autism in other generations.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because implicit in the gene studies, you know, or the genetic studies, is that, you know, if one identical twin has autism, the chance that a second identical twin has autism is greater than 90%, but it's not 100%. And so you would think that if it was strictly a genetic phenomenon, it should be 100%. And so it raises the question, is there something that's triggering this, whether it's something in the environment? And by environment, frankly, what I mean is anything that's not genetic, which is to say, you know, influences that are in the womb, influences after birth that, you know, that could involve things in the environment, things we eat, things we're exposed to, et cetera. And certainly there is money that is being spent trying to answer that question. To date, that doesn't seem to be where the action is, but certainly I think it's a perfectly reasonable question and to ask, and it is in fact something that's being studied.
And I'm sorry, where is the action today when it comes to?
I think the action is and it would be, if anybody has it was interested in this, the July 11th, 2000 issue of Science, and admittedly it's written for scientists, so it's not easy sledding, has a summary of the genetics of autism by a guy named Jim Sutcliffe, who's at Vanderbilt. And what's brilliant, I think, about this simple 2-page study or summary is that he has a table that has these roughly 30 genes, and then he groups them into you know, here are these genes that are associated with how one cell communicates with another. Here are these genes to make proteins that tell you how sort of proteins move through the cell. I mean, that's really, I think that's where the action is, and I think that's where the breakthroughs are going to be. And I do think it's certainly worth looking at environmental issues. I just don't think that's going to be going to be very fruitful.
Next, we go to Eileen in DeForest. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My question, my kids are now 9 and 7, and I haven't had to deal with autism, but when they were babies, I was in a play group, and one of the other mothers had read an article and was considering not having her child vaccinated. And this made me livid. I felt that the only reason she could even consider that was because all of the rest of us did have our children vaccinated. So my question is, what happens if people choose not to vaccinate their children because of this? And so I think
Yeah, thank you very much, Eileen. Yeah, Dr. Offit, that is a that's one of your concerns, isn't it?
Yes, well, it's not theoretical anymore. I mean, you see that in the first half of this year, 2008, mm-hmm. there's been an epidemic of measles in the United States that we have not seen since 1996. And although measles comes into this country, children with measles or adults with measles come into this country every year, I think. What you saw this year that was so frightening is that you know, there were 135 children who were affected. And most of them, meaning more than half of them, parents had chosen not to vaccinate them. And there were in some areas, I think one was in Southern California, actually, where, you know, there were 12 cycles of transmission, meaning person to person to person to person to person, which tells you that at least there are pockets in this country where there's been a critical break in herd immunity. And your guest is absolutely right. I mean, there's 500,000 people in this country who cannot get vaccines because they're immune suppressed, either because they're, you know, they're bone marrow transplants or solid organ transplants, or they're on steroids for one reason or another, and they depend actually on those around them being vaccinated, because otherwise they're in big trouble. And I think, you know, when you see what's happening now in the first half of this year with measles, I think it's a warning shot and quite frightening.
Next, we're going to go to Laura in Bayview. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter has ADHD, and we took her to Dr. Seaman. He had written a book called Feast Without Yeast. And he said, I can prescribe medication, or you can try a diet with taking out malt and vinegar and yeast and any mold-producing products in the food. And it's been difficult to do this diet, but it actually has made a difference in her attention. And I guess the mold or the malt or whatever it is that's in the food, and the maltodextrin is in crackers and cereal, and it's in so many products. It kind of puts the brain to sleep, you know, a non-scientific explanation. But
yeah, and this is one of the gluten-free diet is yet another one that autism is used for autism, isn't it, Dr. Offit?
Yeah, there was a Norwegian biochemist in the 70s named Kalle Reichelt. We talk about him briefly in this book. And what he looked at children who had autism or children who had schizophrenia, and he looked in their urine and he found something called peptides, which are just sort of breakdown products of protein. And he reasoned that these peptides, these abnormal peptides, were there because children weren't adequately processing gluten, you know, which is a grain, or casein, you know, which is a dairy product. And he then postulated that if one avoids those, that in fact you can lessen, you know, the symptoms of autism or schizophrenia. Now, there were five other groups that looked at the urine later to try and say, was this true in children with autism, using much better technology, actually, and could never reproduce that. But despite that, thus was born the notion that, you know, that avoiding gluten or avoiding casein would work. Now, it's really never been, I think, well studied, and it certainly is studyable. It's testable, and I lived through the Secretin story. I guess I'm suspicious of, you know, the gut as being the critical element that's going to make the brain better. But it is testable, and I think that these doctors who are willing to say, you know, do this because it might work or do this because it does work, should at least be willing to subject it to the scientific method, because that's the only way you can answer the question.
I wish we had more time, but in our final minute, what is it you hope listeners will take away from this conversation, or readers from your book?
Well, I hope they take away the notion that at least the vaccine hypothesis has largely been put to rest, but that doesn't mean that there's no hope. I mean, there are, I think, many studies now looking at the genes and the proteins that those genes make that I think could offer real promise in the future, but that we shouldn't be diverted away from that because I think of what, frankly, is largely this at least for some, an anti-science bias, just a disbelief in science because, you know, pharmaceutical companies are involved, the government's involved. I just don't think that serves our society very well.
Dr. Offit, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Paul Offit is the Chief of Infectious Diseases and Director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is author of Autism's False Prophets. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Rob Ferret, and Bill Martins and Cynthia Schuster for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.